against two and two against three. And it isn't even November yet. So much to look forward to. It's fascinating. In so many ways, there's this beautiful reminder to us. People always are willing to remind us that God called us to love, and that is absolutely true. God called us to love. What we forget sometimes is that love, in and of itself, requires that we draw closer to the one that we love. If we're called to live a life of love for God, then it means that living in love means drawing closer to God. That does mean that it may draw us away from others. It does mean that if we know people in our life whose entire life has not been fully dedicated to God, that if we actually grow in our relationship of love, that actually might mean that it pulls us away from those people. It means that we might have a house divided. It actually is pointing to the fact that if we live a life dedicated to God, if we actually live a life witnessing what God's love truly is, it does not mean that it will always draw us together. It will always draw together those united in the common goal of Christ. It will always invite those who have put God first to come together in many ways, but that does not guarantee that all of us will always come together. In fact, he warns us very clearly that it will be a household divided, that it will pull at our relationships, that it will strain at those things that we are trying to develop. And I'm not saying that we're supposed to look forward to trying to pick a fight with our family. I mean, mother-in-law against daughter-in-law is a fight that can be all by itself, but that we actually, without assistance, should be trying to strive for that greater unity, but not afraid if it actually causes a disunity. Sometimes our love can draw us together. I still remember when I was in seminary, there was another seminarian who was in my class who came in a little later. He was a transfer student in so many ways, and he was a little older than I was. I'm very shocked, but he was a little older than I was. He had gone off and had a military career before he entered seminary, and his parents had passed away during his time in the military, and he was still very close to his grandparents, even though his parents had passed away. And he was raised Baptist, so he was a good old Baptist and became Catholic, and about 10 years after he became Catholic, he entered seminary. And his grandparents were still Baptist. We're talking to him one day about his entering seminary. And they asked him, and his grandmother asked him earnest, she said, "Since you're becoming a priest, does that mean that your grandfather and I have to become Catholic?" And he paused for a second, and then he said, "Absolutely." It's a really touching moment there, and actually they, of their own accord, decided to become Catholic as he was in seminary. They didn't wait for the deadline that they thought that they had, and it was this beautiful moment because it did, it brought them closer together. It was this, by the way, that's not a rule, I don't want anyone to think something that's a rule, that no, that's not actually a real rule. He was having a little fun with his grandmother, but that love brought them together. It was a great witness of striving to live the greatest spiritual gifts, that great reminder of how it is that if they separate themselves from the things of this world, that they actually draw close to Christ and brought them together. But there's no guarantee of that. I can't promise you that following after Christ is going to be some magic moment that makes everything better in life. In fact, Jesus says two very distinct things in this gospel. He says first that he wants to set the earth on fire. There's this longing to set ablaze the whole world with the love of God. And then he points out that it's going to cause division. There's going to be those who don't like the idea of having to actually follow after God. There are going to be those who would prefer to pursue their own interests, to pursue their own ideas, to pursue all of their own gifts rather than actually follow after God. Never underestimate what G.K. Chesterton said so well when he said that the life of Catholicism, the Catholicism as a way of life, has not been tried and found wanting, but rather was found difficult and then left untried. And it's remarkable, because we might think of ourselves that all of our problems are somehow new, and yet I want to remind you that Jeremiah actually has a very current problem in front of him when he struggles in today's gospel. Don't underestimate what the end of the book of Jeremiah is. It's 38th chapter of Jeremiah. This is coming down to the wire. They are besieged. Jerusalem is besieged by the Babylonian Empire. And spoiler alert, in case you didn't know, the Babylonians take Jerusalem during the time of Jeremiah. So I already know what happens in just a couple of chapters. They're under siege, and I know how it's going to end. Jeremiah goes through the city, and he does exactly what he's been told to do since a very young age. He goes through and he explains to everyone in the city what it's going to take to return back to a life of God. And then he warns them and says that if we don't turn back, if we don't change our lives now and return to God and put our trust in Him, we're going to die. And here's the response. He goes through the city and he explains to them what it takes to get back to the life of God and what it's going to happen if they don't return to the life of God. And instead of saying, "My gosh, Jeremiah, you're right." Or it was like Jonah and Nineveh. Instead of saying, "My gosh, Jeremiah, you're right. We should turn back to God. We should repent now. We should ask for God's forgiveness for the things that we've done wrong." Instead, they go to the king. And here's what they say. They said, "Have you killed Jeremiah yet? Because what he's saying is hurting our feelings, and it upsets us that he says those things. It's very upsetting that he says those things." Notice nowhere in the entire passage does it ever say that they think Jeremiah is lying or he's wrong. Never comes up. It never actually says, "You know, Jeremiah just accused us of some terrible things that we didn't do." They don't say that. Their exact words are, "Jeremiah ought to be put to death." Why? Because he's demoralizing us. He keeps speaking things that don't interest us. And don't be here to improving our welfare. He keeps talking about how we're going to be destroyed. He doesn't tell them things that they think are untrue. He doesn't tell them things that they know are untrue. He doesn't say anything that they already don't know they should already be doing. But what he says is boring, and it makes them feel bad. And instead of saying, "You know, it's a good point, Jeremiah. What you're saying makes me feel bad. I should do something to improve my way of life so that I no longer feel bad." No, instead what they say is, "That's a good point, Jeremiah. How can we kill you?" So they go to the king and they said, "Why don't you kill him? You know, just make it easy for the rest of us. Why don't you just kill him?" The king won't kill him either, by the way. He says he's in your power and he consents to his death. He knows that he's consenting to his death. But he won't give a kill order. No, instead, they want to put him away. Think about this. They don't like what he has to say, so they tune him out. They put him in a dry well. Relatively speaking, I mean, it has no water, so it's a dry well, but of course it's muddy on the bottom because it used to be a well. So they put him in a dry well where he will starve to death because there's no way out. There's no water, there's no food, and he's going to starve to death. And they put it in a remote section of the city. Remember, that it points out that they put it in a well in the quarter of the guard. So literally, the soldiers who put them there are the only ones who will pass by. He will not see anyone else, and he will die. If you think about it, it's kind of a relationship with our conscience. You know, when our conscience makes us feel bad, instead of trying to actually improve upon our life, we have two choices. We can either improve upon our life so our conscience stops nagging at us, or we can try and bury our conscience so that we can't hear it. You know, let's just find a nice well where we can kind of put it down, and we don't have to think about it. You know, if the voice dies eventually, then we don't hear it anymore. Then we don't feel bad, right? And God doesn't give up on Jeremiah either, by the way. God, still firmly in mind, still keeping his promise to Jeremiah that he will look after him, moves the heart of Abimelech, the court official. And Abimelech goes to the king and he says, "Are you really going to kill God's prophet?" King shows wonderful spine here. First he gives him to the guards, then he gives him to Abimelech. He actually doesn't, you know, he actually doesn't have any strength himself. He's like, "Well, you know, you guys know what you think is best." They have conflicting opinions. "Yeah, both of you do what you think is best." Abimelech goes and saves Jeremiah and pulls him out of the well and brings him back out. And it points out two incredible things to me. Just truly remarkable things to me. The first of which is, as we draw closer to God, as we live a life of love and actually respond to that conscience that drives us crazy, it is going to put off some people. And living a life of love does not guarantee that everyone's going to be happy with us, but rather some are actually going to be upset with us. The second thing that it points out, and I think this is so very important, is consider for a moment the relationship between Jeremiah and God. The very beginning of the book of Jeremiah, God says to him, he says, as long as you preach my word and you present it to the people the way I tell you to, I will never abandon you. Fast forward 38 chapters. Jeremiah has been faithful to God. Time and again, he has preached exactly what God has told him to preach. Time and again, he has faithfully followed through on exactly what God has asked him to. And look where it got him, staring up from the bottom of the well, thinking to himself, this is where I'm going to die. Thanks, God. I really appreciate it. That was great. But God didn't abandon him. God never gave up on him. God moved the heart of the court official, even now, and he ensured that Jeremiah was pulled out of the well. He didn't die. He was not forgotten. There may be that dark time in our life, that time when we're sitting at the bottom of the well wondering if God really gave up on us. You know, maybe God got tired of hearing us. But he never forgets us. He does not abandon us. And he faithfully sees us through. So the two things to remember in so very beautiful way is that we are still called to God's love. We should respond to it to our very level best ability. Never being afraid that it may put off some people. The second of which is if we live into that love, if we live into the great witness of who God is, he will not abandon us. We may have dark moments, we may have those uncertainties, but God does not abandon his people, and he never forgets us.